August 5th, 2015. This interview recounts John Wasmuth's memories of growing up in the UP and participation in World War II and his return to the Upper Peninsula following the war. This is Dr. Gabe Logan, Center for Upper Peninsula Studies, as well as
Catherine Johnson, NMU Department of History.
And Mr. Wasmuth. So, if we can go ahead and start, sir. Could you please identify yourself and give us a correct spelling of your name?
This is John Wasmuth. Common spelling John, not common spelling Wasmuth. W-A-S-M-U-T-H.
All right. And could you tell us when you were born, please, and when and where?
Not the time, but the date.
Yeah, the date.
March 30th, 1926. Okay. That'll be 90 years ago pretty soon.
Okay. And you mentioned you were born in?
I was born in a mining company's dispensary. I was supposed to be born in the Ishring Hospital, but there was a humongous snowstorm, and my mother couldn't get from the Ghana to Ishring. And the mining company had a little building there where if the guys were hurt or sick, they'd go there, and they had a doctor on time. And I wound up in a clothes basket there, they tell me.
Which mining company was that?
Cleveland Cliffs.
Cleveland Cliffs, all right. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about your childhood and family and the community you grew up in?
Well, until I was 9 years old, I lived in Nagani. Went to the old K Street School, which is no longer there. And when I was 9 years old, my dad was transferred to Marquette, so they moved here. And, of course, they brought me and my brother along.
What kind of work did your father do that he was transferred?
He was an insurance inspector. The reason he used to go live in Nagani is that the train connections were good out of Nagani. They weren't out of Marquette at that time. But then they started doing all their own driving, and at that point, they didn't care where you were.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, before World War II broke out in before Pearl Harbor, how did the communities, as you remember, regard what was going on in Europe and Asia prior to United States entry?
They were sound asleep.
Were you working at the time?
Let's see, I was still going to school. Hmm. I think when Pearl Harbor happened, I was like a sophomore in high school, something like that.
Hmm. Do you recall when the news broke of Pearl Harbor, when you first heard about it?
Yeah, I was bowling with a couple of my buddies, and somebody came in and said, the Japanese are bombing Pearl Harbor. And I said, what's that all about? There's a war. And I was, of course, no more than 15. I didn't think I had any personal involvement, but I can remember how far out they were. They had a, the high school there was three or four story building, and they set up a deal on the roof where people could watch to see if any airplanes came. And I got into that thing, and for about a year every night I'd go from, what was it, 2 to 6 or something at night and look for the Japanese planes that never came.
Was that in the Graverette building on Front Street? Yeah, wow. I've been up there. I've heard those stories from somebody who gave me a tour up there. It was hard to believe that they had you all doing that as kids.
Yeah. I don't really think they had anything they could get this far.
Could you say that again, please?
I don't think that the Japanese had anything they would have thrown away over the weekend.
No.
They were worried about it anyway.
Did you choose to enlist, or were you drafted?
No. When I was graduating, they had several offers they'd give you. A couple of them were college programs, and then the Navy Department. I was a radio ham with the highest level license. And the Navy Department would send me a letter saying, because of had a Class A license, if I wanted to enlist in the Navy, I could get a second class rating right off. Or the Marine Corps would give you a Staff Sergeant's rating. And the Army at that time couldn't do anything with you until you were 18. The Naval Department could enlist you at 17. So I like a dumb fool that the Army had a program. Their cadet program required you to get a certain amount of college. And they could have you enlist in what they call the reserve. And they could send you to get a year of your college on the way. And I got into that and spent a year at Michigan State. And when that was all over, I had two choices, either go with some infantry outfit or stay with the aviation program, which of course I took. And that was a stupid thing because I never learned to fly or not anything.
So, all right, so then you joined the Navy?
No, the Air Force.
The Air Force, okay.
Army.
Okay, so you're the Army Air Force, all right.
Yeah.
Where did you do basic training?
At Shepherd Field, Texas.
Boy, that was probably quite a bit different than the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, that was at Wichita Falls, Texas, up in the corner of the Panhandle. Awfully hot, awful lot of bugs.
Was that the first time you'd been out of the UP, other than to go to school at Michigan State?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
What do you recall about meeting your other service, the other servicemen being from, were they also from different parts of the country, or?
Yeah, at Shepherd Field, they're from all over. But I would say the majority were from Illinois or Michigan.
Hmm. Do you remember what a day-to-day routine was like in basic training?
I'd rather not. They had a southern boy was a sergeant who ran our area. And this was kind of vulgar, but he would come in about 4 in the morning and say, "All right, you bastards, drop your cocks and put on your socks." I've always remembered that, but he was an ignorant bastard.
That's funny.
After basic training, where did you go from there?
Childress, Texas, which is in the Panhandle, and I was supposed to be learning to be a bombardier, but they closed the school down before I got very far into it. And then where else did they send me? They sent me to Lowry Field out in Denver to be a fire control officer. You could get out of there. So I went to Denver and wasted 6 months waiting for the school to start, and they never did. Then they sent me down to Harlingen, Texas to become an aerial gunner. I got down there and they were closing it down. I sat there for a couple months wasting. And then they sent me over to a field at Fort Myers Ford, Buckingham Field, it was called. It's not there anymore. But that was, that, then I went through what they call B-29 Gunnery School. And incidentally, B-29 gunners, it was so stupid, they'd start you off, put you in the back of a truck, drive on, and have the pigeons fly out and try to shoot them. Yet in the B-29, you couldn't get anywhere near your guns. It was all remote controlled. You had a gun sight with a couple of wheels on it, and it could figure out by, as the plane's wings got bigger because they're getting closer, you turn this thing and keep a bunch of dots around the, and then you hit the button and it would fire automatically. The original B-29s had 250 caliber guns and a 20 millimeter cannon in the back. But that didn't work too well, so they went to four 50 caliber machine guns, which the same gun that's in the BAR, Browning Automatic, that the infantry uses.
Where did you go overseas then?
Well, I was sent to Tinian Island over by China. They had a B-29 base there. And same old shit. I just got nicely settled in there. I made a couple of flights in the war. And so that was the end of my career in the military.
What year was that?
It had to be 46, I think.
Okay, and you, did you say, I'm sorry, where did you get shipped to?
T-I-N-T-I-A-N. Tinian Island, it was between Japan and China, over in the China Sea.
Oh, okay. I see, okay.
Yeah, there were hundreds of B-29s here. That was a great airplane, you know.
Yeah. When you got over there, what were your living conditions like? It's obviously a base, but...
Well, it was kind of tough growing up. We lived in tents over there. I used to say, we had an intense training.
Did you have any interactions with the local populations?
Not much.
It was mostly military personnel then?
No.
What was your military job overseas, and could you describe a typical day?
Well, if you were flying a mission, they'd get you up early and feed you and put you in the plane and off they'd go. It took quite a while, even from Tinian, to get to Japan. And incidentally, they always, the General Curtis LeMay, who is in charge of the 20th Air Force over there, if there ever was a war criminal, it was him. He decided that the bombs weren't doing enough good before they had the big one available. So we dropped tons of napalm on Japanese cities. And I'm sure we killed a lot of women and children. But what the hell? They tell you to do it, you gotta do it. Oh, man, I think he's long gone now.
Yeah, actually, I believe he was from Oklahoma, if I'm not mistaken.
Who was?
General LeMay.
I don't know where he was from, but I hope he's in hell now.
All right, duly noted.
Yeah, when the B-29s first started bombing Japan, they were told to go in at 40,000 feet. And when LeMay took over, he changed that to 20,000 feet. And so going in at 20,000 feet, you're a lot easier to shoot down. Nobody liked that, but he was the boss.
Did that improve the accuracy from the
bombs? It did, yeah. It also improved the accuracy of the Japanese anti-aircraft.
Wow.
Sure. Yeah, that works both ways, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned dropping napalm. So were the bombing missions dropping different kinds of bombs? And
yeah, they had the regular explosive bombs, and then they had what they call incendiaries that were, I forget what the metal was, but some powdered metal, and they would burn. And if you drop them on a wood building, it would take a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't good enough for Curtis. He went to napalm, which I thought was terrible shit to use.
Mm-hmm.
But we apparently won the war, so he did something right.
Do you recall interactions with any other commanders other than, LeMay, of course, was at the top of the chain, but...
Yeah, I didn't have any personal contact with that son of a bitch. But the, I'm trying to think who our squadron, the levels were squadron and then wing and then air something. So LeMay was about four levels above anything I had anything to do with. And kind of interesting, just before you came in, a friend of mine who was a B-52 pilot during the Vietnam War flying out of Guam. He stopped in to see me because we've been friends forever. He got to be a full colonel, and he was a top man at Sawyer for a while until he retired. But he liked the UP, so he bought a house out in the woods and staying right here.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Dave Vandenberg.
Vandenberg? Vandenberg.
Vandenberg.
Vandenberg. Like, remember there was a senator from Grand Rapids with the same name.
Okay, sure.
Never know relation, but.
How did your comrades in arms and the other soldiers on the base, as the war was going on, was there any sense of the direction of the war and how it was progressing and how you
all... I had a cousin who since passed away. It was a, what they call him, a Marine Raider. And his immediate boss was Jim Roosevelt, the president's kid, and he said, "It didn't do us any good." He said, "I thought with Roosevelt's kid running our group, why, we'd have the best of everything." He said, "I think we didn't get anything special." Yeah, he had a tough job. The Japanese had a lot of little islands over in the Pacific where they'd have an observer or two and a radio so they could report anything they saw of our shipping or that. And their job was to go in there and unfortunately kill all the Japs there and destroy the radio stuff. But those raiders are really tough dudes.
Yeah.
Well, on a lighter note, did you ever have any recreations on the island, sports or movies or?
Not much, no.
It's pretty much daily work, hey?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you one thing funny. They used to serve a breakfast, kind of an oatmeal, and they were always full of little worms. And you could tell how long a guy had been there. If he was a new man, he'd pick the worms out. If he'd been there a while, he wouldn't bother. If he'd been there too long, if a worm crawled out, he'd throw it back in.
Oh, my gosh. Did you get to the point where you were eating the worms too?
No, I never. I was a pick-em-out type of guy. I was always a fussy eater as a kid, and I didn't want to get my protein from worms.
How did you regard the other branches of the military, the Army and the Navy and the Marines?
We never had any trouble with them.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were doing a good job. And, a lot of my friends were in other branches, Navy and so forth. They were smarter than me.
Were there service members from other branches on your base?
Oh, the Navy had some B-24s off of Tinian, and it wasn't as big a deal as the B-29s the Air Force had, but they were pretty active. I worked with a guy in Detroit who had been a pilot on one of those 24s, had thousands of hours. When the war was over, they were offered pilot jobs with the airlines, and he said, "I'm never getting in a goddamn airplane again."
Mm-hmm. when you were serving, how did you and the base consider the allies, such as the United States allies during World War II?
The only objection we had, the Australians used to sell mutton, which is a goat or a sheep, something terrible tasting crap. But that's all we were getting was mutton.
Okay.
One of the guys used to sing, "I've had plenty of mutton, and mutton's terrible for me."
Where were you when you heard about Victory in Europe Day and Victory in Japan Day?
Oh, when the Victory in Europe, and I had a brother that was deeply involved in that. He was an infantryman, a first sergeant with the 197th Division, which pretty much cleaned up Czechoslovakia. But I was glad to hear that the Germans had finally decided to quit, because I always worried about my brother. But he was fine.
Which brother was that? What was his name?
Who?
What was your brother's name?
Rodney.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then when Victory in Japan Day took place?
Yeah. Boy, they went crazy where I was.
Where were you at that point?
I was back in the States. A field out, I think it was in North Dakota. And when they announced that the Japs had given up, why, they had a party like you wouldn't believe.
Were you on a military base, or were you working as a civilian?
No, I was still in the military at VJJ.
Okay.
Go ahead, please.
After the VJ Day, they didn't give a damn what you did. They wouldn't send you home yet, but you had no duties at all. I had been a pretty thorough trombone player in my younger. I got in the Air Force band after the war. So I was waiting for my name to come up to go home. Anyway, I was out in Brentwood, Long Island, if you ever heard of that. It was a mental hospital that they'd taken over from the state for the GIs that had gone off the deep end. And I was in a little jazz group that I used to try to entertain them. That's when it ended, and that's when I got home.
Do you remember some of the music that you used to play, or some of the tunes?
Oh, yeah. I think one of the favorites was, what the hell, Joe Head doesn't work anymore. But that was in the Glenn Miller area, where I played a lot of Miller songs like Pardon Me Boy and all that crap.
How did you get back to the United States from Japan when your military did? How did you return back to the States?
Yeah, we flew over there, and I had to take a boat ride home.
Oh.
I didn't care for that, but what the hell.
After the war was over, how did the local communities regard the U.S. troops and returning back home?
Well, it was on lip service, we were heroes. Every other way, they said, get lost, you asshole.
When did you come back to the Upper Peninsula?
Well, I worked for Underwriters Laboratory after I got my education, which was at the University of Maryland. I don't know what the hell I was doing out there, but they had a curricula for fire protection engineers, and I was working for a bunch of insurance, fire insurance companies in Michigan that hired those guys to investigate arson and a lot of other things. Hmm. It was an interesting job, but I always say it sure as hell beats working.
Was that mostly downstate or in the UP or both?
Well, they covered the whole state, but for me, I was out of Detroit for about 20 years. Oh. And finally, they had a resident engineer in Marquette who retired. They came to me, you're an old Uber, aren't you? I said, hell yes. You want to go back up there? I said, hell yes. So I wound up in Marquette again.
What was Detroit like after the war?
It was a mess. There was a racial problems and everything. Even though the blacks had done a lot to help with the war, they were still treated like something from another planet. And I wasn't in there the day they had that big riot down there. I was taking a ride to Detroit to our office for a little meeting on that day. And the fellow that I worked with in the UP, he and I were riding down there in his car. And we got to the Detroit area, we're heading downtown, and all these stores were getting busted into and everything, the alarms going off. And I said, what the hell are we doing here? And he said, it must be sidewalk sales. I said, sure, it ever is. Anyway, we finally got downtown, checked into what's the name of that ice cream outfit? They had a hotel down right across from our office. Howard Johnson, that's it, isn't it?
Okay.
Yeah, they had a hotel. We checked in there and didn't leave for about 4 days because it was too dangerous to put your nose outside. That was an interesting experience.
That would be. So with that similar question with the racial discrimination, did you witness any of that in the military?
No. We had a couple of blacks in our outfit that were real nice guys. We got along great. But on the other hand, there was a lot going on in the cities. A lot of discrimination. In fact, it was the race war was terrible, but it was about time the guys asserted themselves, maybe.
Do you think World War II had something to do with that?
Well, it had something to do with there were blacks who couldn't find a job. They would give them a job at a war plant. And if they weren't in the service, they were working, making good money someplace, which they couldn't do before. And then when the war was over, some of these crackers thought they should go back to the good old days, and the blacks didn't believe in it. I didn't either.
Mm-hmm. When let me change subjects again here to in the 1950s. I ask this because Senator Joe McCarthy was kind of the UP's neighbor.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Joe McCarthy and his coming into power and the anti-communist campaigns in the area?
He was a goddamn fool.
Okay. What made him so foolish to, in your...
Well, he was paranoid about, I guess you could call him a super conservative, but also happened to be an asshole. I met him one time, and I told him, I said, why don't you back off? And he said, well, I'm just doing what the country needs. And I said, shit, they do. They need you like they need another war. He caused lots of problems.
Mm-hmm. Did you have the chance to meet him?
Yeah.
Where was that?
It was in Milwaukee. I was down there for a little session with Underwriter's Lab, and we were staying in a hotel where he happened to be staying. And that's how I ran into him one day. I don't think he enjoyed our meeting.
When you returned to the Upper Peninsula then, it must have been the 60s, mid-60s or so.
Let's see, it was 1962, so I would have been about 60.
How had the Upper Peninsula changed noticeably, in your opinion, or?
Well, it was a tough situation for kids who got out of school and couldn't find jobs unless they wanted to be an underground miner, which was a dangerous way to live. I remember at one time, this one mine, a guy that ran it, was trying to save money, and he didn't shore it up enough with timber, and they'd have cave-ins all the time there. And then somebody asked him, why don't you put more timber in your mines? He said, Finlanders are cheaper than timber.
Wow.
Oh, what an attitude, eh?
Jeez.
One of the dirty jobs, the Finns were coming in here by the thousands and getting all the dirty jobs. And every town has their one race that they ridicule all the time. Milwaukee has the Germans, and Detroit had the Polacks that got held. And Marquette had Finns. Mm-hmm. Most of the Finns are very good people. They're interested in education. I think Northern probably turns out more Finnish graduates than anything else.
I think you're probably right on that.
And that's still the case. There's still a lot of descendants of those Finnish immigrants who are students at NMU.
I went to NMU for a little while when I first got out, about one semester, I guess. And then I had to get a chance to go I just mentioned it.
Maryland,
yeah. It was called College Park. It was practically in downtown Washington. It was a good school. They had a doctor there teaching the fire protection who had a lot of interesting ideas.
Hmm.
One day he said, I'm going to talk about fire extinguishers. And he was talking. He said, I'll tell you one thing. Don't have one in your house. I said, why not, Doc? And he said, because you too often we hear about there's smoke coming up from the basement, so Daddy grabs a fire extinguisher and heads down the basement, and they never see him alive again.
Oh, jeez.
Stupid. They go down there and get asphyxiated from the fumes. He said, if you have your house fire, get the hell out and call the fire department somehow. He was quite a nice guy. I still hear from him once in a while.
Huh. That's great.
when you moved back, did you start a family then in Marquette? And
I had started a family in Detroit. My dear ex-wife, who's now gone to her reward, was unable to have kids for some reason. I forget which. And we adopted two kids. They turned out to be wonderful kids. We adopted them from a Catholic Sarah Fisher home, they called it. One of the rich Fishers wanted to do something for the poor girls that were getting knocked up and had no money. So she established a home out there. If a girl was pregnant, she could go out there and they'd take care of her and everything. And when the baby was born, they'd put it up for adoption so they could get a clean start again.
Mm-hmm.
But my daughter is about 55 now. She's been a flight attendant for 30 years, I guess. She was mainly with Northwest, and they had a bunch of crooks on there. And the employees had a big fund for pensions. And so old Northwest took all the employees' pension money and bought Delta Airlines out of Atlanta. And now it's all called Delta because Northwest didn't have a very good reputation.
Mm-hmm.
So my daughter's a flight attendant with Delta who has no pension to look forward to. In fact, this whole country, I think, has been over-pensioned. And it's going to be tough on these young people now. They'll get to be old and want to retire and they won't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you're not interested in my rambling, I'm sorry.
No, actually.
It's especially relevant for our students who are graduating from the university and going into this economic climate, and they're facing that obstacle.
I think it's still okay. Most of the northern graduates seem to find a teaching job or something. But I think that day is going to end one of these days.
Mm-hmm.
I had a visit yesterday from the son of one of my best buddies. And he's a northern graduate. He's been teaching down at Engadine for 20 years, I guess. And the odd thing about it, his mother was a granddaughter of J.M. Longyear.
Oh, how about that?
So his folks have both died now. His dad was my lifelong buddy. But anyway, he inherited around $9 million.
He got the Longyear fortune,
huh? He's not teaching anymore. He's a great kid. And he takes time to stop and see this whole fight. I don't know why he does, but I always appreciate his visits.
Mm-hmm.
Getting back to the war and coming back to the UP, it's kind of a difficult question, but what did the war mean to you and your generation?
We didn't know it would ever end. So you try to adjust your job. How could you get a good commission or something with the military? At one time I was living on Front Street in Marquette, and the family next door had a son who was maybe 3 or 4 years older than me, but he got to be quite a guy in the Navy. He went to Annapolis instead of Northern, and incidentally his dad was on the staff at Northern, but he still went to Annapolis. And when the war ended, he had the rank of captain, which is about high as you can go without being a general or an admiral. And he came back to Marquette and he worked for Northern for a while until he passed away about 10 years ago. name was Dave McClintock.
Oh, okay. I believe we have a building named after him there on campus.
Yeah. There's a McClintock building on campus.
That could be after his dad, maybe, who was there forever. Northern, when they got Hardin in as the president, they start rebuilding the whole campus. And just about every building they rebuilt or repaired was named after somebody that worked there in the faculty or something.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple lived across the street from me when I was growing up. His name was Spooner. I think they named the building after him and all.
Mm-hmm. They sure did. It's a residence hall now.
Spooner Hall.
Yep.
He had a crazy wife. If a mailman or anybody else would come up on the porch and put something in their mailbox, she'd have him out there washing everything down. She was one of these German nuts, you know. And we weren't allowed to go over there because she was so crazy.
Do you recall, did you ever visit K.I. Sawyer while it was in its...
Oh, sure. When I got back to Marquette, one of my friends had gotten to be kind of a big wheel in the Civil Air Patrol. And he got me involved in that, and I'd have to go to Sawyer and do stuff for a lot.
What was the Civil Air Patrol? Was that a volunteer?
Yeah.
Position?
It's sort of like the Coast Guard's got a Coast Guard auxiliary, which is basically civilians, and Civil Air Patrol is basically civilians. And that was kind of funny because they were all trying to play soldier out, the Civil Air Patrol people. When I joined it, I did the favor to my friend. They said, "What rank would you like to have?" I said, "How about general?" "No, we only have one in the country." I said, "How about a colonel? We only allowed one of those in Michigan." I said, "What do you want me to do?" I always admired the warrant officer rating. And so they made me a chief warrant officer, which is all bullshit, you know. There's a bunch of adults playing soldiers.
Were there airplanes involved? I mean, you say it's Air Patrol, so were you flying?
The Marquette Squadron had four old World War II, what do they call them, J-13 Piper Cubs. And they had one guy who'd been a pilot in the war. Jules Larson, his name was, and he wrecked all of them. He was a nutcase. He put the Civil Air Patrol in the market out of business completely. He was in here, you know, a year or two ago. I was talking to him, and he did one stupid thing. He was always doing stunts and that, you know, and he was flying upside down on Shag Lake. And, like a jerk, he pulled back on the stick to go up, and it went, shoot.
Oh, no.
Almost killed him, took his head off, his hair off. And anyway, he was that kind of a guy. I said, "I'll never fly with you, Jules." He said, "I don't care."
So did he ruin the airplane then?
Huh?
Was the airplane ruined? Did he crash?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
He ruined either three or four of the Civil Air Patrol airplanes. He would do something stupid every time. But they were so hard up for anybody that could fly that they didn't get rid of them.
Sounds like they let anybody in.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Anybody that, especially if you had your own airplane, they'd really want you to join.
Hmm.
Was the purpose of the Civil Air Patrol to protect the Marquette area, to do, like, keep an eye on the skies?
Well, there wasn't any story about, but if a plane disappeared, they'd go on a search.
Okay.
They'd get maybe a dozen people looking for them. crashed airplane.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did that ever happen?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I felt kind of stupid. The fellow was, with his family, was heading for Escanaba, I think, and they said he never went over Iron Mountain. So we had planes all over that didn't see a damn thing. And I put a ground crew out there, about 10 young guys like to do that, looking for it, and they found the damn thing in the woods down there, and everybody was dead, of course. Mm. And the other thing about that, I'm boring the shit out of you.
No, this is great.
Yeah.
No. Had no idea there was a civil air patrol going around Marquette.
Yeah, during the war over on the East Coast, the civil air patrol citizens would go on submarine searches looking for submarines off the coast. Hmm. And they did some pretty good work.
Yeah. Hmm. Anything else? Is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview, or thoughts about the war, or the present, or any other points you'd care to elaborate on?
No. Just to say I was no war hero or anything else. Just a poor slob trying to survive.
I think a lot of people were in that same position, yeah. Right? Just trying to make ends meet and get by and get from one day to the next, and that's part of the human experience, right?
Everybody would get drafted if they didn't join something. The guys, anytime you were past 18, you were subject to getting drafted. And a lot of the guys enlisted to avoid their draft, which was kind of stupid. It's like killing yourself so you won't get sick.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall ever hearing about any of the prison of war camps in the UP during the war?
They had one over at Sidna, Sidnaw.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a bunch of Germans over there, and they were working in the woods, cutting trees down and that's kind of doing a lot. They were loggers, and they were kind of happy to be out of the war, you know, but they weren't too worried about them. Most of them weren't going to try to escape. Where the hell would you go, for one thing? Anyway, I happened to be inspecting that place 10 or 15 years later, and a car pulled up. The guy got out with his family. He said, I'm just going to show where I was during the war. And I said, fine, make yourself at home. He'd been a German prisoner there for a couple of years. He was showing his family where he was.
Wow.
I don't know if there were any other very extensive prisoner of war camps.
Mm-hmm. You have any other questions, Ben?
Mm-hmm.
All right, sir. We certainly appreciate your time. And
well, I enjoyed it.
This has been a fascinating interview.
Anyway, what the hell? 89 still going, that's a miracle there. I'll be 90 come March if I get through the winter. I used to say when I was young I wanted to live to 90 and get shot by a jealous husband. I'll tell you that, I'm 89, that ain't gonna happen.
That's probably a good thing, sir.
All right, then. I'm going to go ahead and sign off. And this was with John Wasmuth and Gabe Logan and Catherine Johnson.
Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you for your time.
I enjoyed it.